following podcast is a recording of a presentation from Akin Gump Strauss Hauer & Feld, LLP, entitled Privacy and Data Protection Legislation, The Risk and What Corporate Counsel Need to Know. This presentation was originally given on October 5, 2011, by Akin Gump attorneys Francine Friedman, Joe Ellen Klein, Dan McGinnis, and Jamie Tucker.
We're glad everyone could join us today. The four of us are from Akin's Washington office, and we're pleased to be able to talk to you about the legislative and regulatory landscape on privacy issues. I'm going to start with some introductions. To my right, your left, is Jo Ellen Klein, who is an attorney in our healthcare practice. She has the dubious honor of leading the privacy and data security practice, which is an interdisciplinary practice at the firm. In the healthcare space, she advises clients on HIPAA, high tech, red flag issues, and her clients range from hospitals to pharmacy chains to even professional sports leagues. To my left, your right, is Francine Friedman. She's a colleague of mine in our public law and policy section, which means she advises and lobbies on behalf of clients on a range of issues, including data and privacy and security. In that space, her clients include data brokers, companies that market to consumers, and even private prison providers. To her left is Dan McGinnis, who is a trade and antitrust lawyer. His practice really focuses on all things FTC. On the privacy space, he advises clients on privacy practices, due diligence as part of deals, and on issues including litigation. And currently, he is suing the FTC on a issue related to the Do Not Call legislation. My name is Jamie Tucker. I'm with the Public Law and Policy Practice, and my involvement in privacy and data security issues goes back to 2005, when a client that was a data broker experienced a somewhat significant data breach. It was by no means the first data breach, or certainly the last, but it was the first one that really caught Congress's attention. And the CEO and the senior management of that client made five appearances before congressional committees over a seven-week period. As you can imagine, that was not a very pleasant experience for them, but we got them successfully to the other side of that. And so hopefully today we can share with you a little bit of insight so that you can avoid putting your bosses in similar situations and going forward. So we're going to start with an overview of what's going on in Washington in this space, in the legislative arena. Congress has been very active, certainly with the impetus of the 05 legislation, and they've had a great deal of momentum on the issue ever since. And I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Francine Friedman. Before I do, I'm just going to share with you, here's the roadmap of the discussion today. You will see this slide throughout the presentation as we sort of make our way through it and just provide a little road mark. Francine.
Thank you, Jamie. As Jamie said, you've heard quite a lot recently about data security and breaches. There have been a constant stream of breaches which have focused the media and the public attention on consumer privacy and data security issues, breaches where people didn't know who had their information or why they had it. And I think that's really the crux of this, is that consumers are starting to learn that information is being shared. And they're not sure how comfortable they are with this. Some of them are very comfortable with it. Some of them are not as comfortable. And it's just a process. We're sort of at the beginning of the privacy debate with a lot of consumers because they hadn't known for years and years, despite the fact that they may have been applying for publishers' clearinghouse. Why do you think they collected all of that information? People don't put two and two together. And when you start talking about tracking people's activities online or sharing purchasing history, things like that, you do have some consumers that begin to feel concerned. You also have consumer advocates and consumer groups that are probably more concerned than the consumers, but they are very active. They have been out there working with a lot of lawmakers, and they really have gotten many of them to the point where they do feel compelled to respond to this series of breaches that we've seen. And it's very interesting the amount of press coverage we've seen recently. You've probably seen the Wall Street Journal's series on what they know about you. It seems like almost every day there's coverage of a new breach or a new privacy complaint. There was outrage over the Sony and Epsilon breaches, particularly with Sony when it had to do with children. I think a lot of people begin to feel even more concerned when they think, well, what my child is doing with regard to, you know, their online games and things like that being shared or being breached makes them very concerned. And then there's just sort of that general creepy factor that people talk about with relevant advertising. And I do like to call it relevant advertising, not targeted advertising. And I encourage all of you to do that, too, as you talk about these issues, because I think targeted has a connotation that may make people nervous. Relevant, you say, oh, yeah, if I'm going to get ads, they may as well be ads that are relevant to me for things I'm interested in. But I will say every single day I talk to somebody, you know, who's not involved in this field, and I say, this is, you know, what I work on. And they say, oh, yeah, you know, I saw this ad the other day that was the exact pair of shoes I was looking at or a rug that I had been looking at, and it was on a website that was not related to this at all. And I said, yeah, that's, you know, good, right? You wanted to go back. You wanted to buy that. You were comfortable with it. Some people think it's good. Some people are a little nervous about it. So, again, you got these lawmakers who are feel very compelled to respond when they hear from people about it. And I think the interesting thing you're going to see is as we go through some of these bills, there are some really strange bedfellows on this. This is one issue where there has been bipartisan, bicameral activity, attention, and support. And some of these bedfellows in particular I want to just mention for you all. There's one bill with Congressman Markey and Congressman Barton. And to give you a little bit about them, Congressman Markey is the chair of the Special Committee on Climate Change. And Congressman Barton from Texas called for an apology to BP. Well, these two got together because they're concerned about particularly children's online privacy. So these two guys on total opposite ends in the spectrum of almost everything they do, neither one of them probably wants the other one to have their job next year, but they're going to get together on this. And my other favorite example of these bedfellows are Senator Kerry and Senator McCain, two failed presidential nominees. Couldn't be more different, but they got together on a privacy bill as well. And again, it's because there's this overwhelming feeling that they need to respond. I'm not sure you're really getting that from consumers, but you're definitely getting it from consumer groups. So what does that mean? Well, there have been 18 bills already introduced by members of both parties in both chambers. As I said, some have bipartisan support. There have been at least 17 hearings. There's actually one going on this morning on children's online privacy. There have been many, many congressional committees that cover this issue. Everybody wants their hand in this. There's the Energy and Commerce Committee, the Judiciary Committee, Commerce Committee on the Senate side. You know, so we've got a whole bunch of folks who are involved in this, and there have been all kinds of roundtables and discussions about it. So to give you a sense of what we're looking at and what our team has to deal with every day and what you all need to be thinking about in terms of what might impact you, we put together a guide to cover the three primary areas of these bills. The first area is online and point of sale privacy. So what's done with your information once you give it to a retailer, for example, can they share it? And what do they need to tell you before they share it? Or what kind of permission do they need to get before they share it? And who can they share it with? Because there are definitely some distinctions between internal sharing and external sharing. And my favorite example of the value of my information as well as yours just came out recently. I got an email from Barnes & Noble telling me they had bought Borders email list. Well, if that's not an example of value, I don't know what is. They paid money for a list. That's it right there. Well, some of these bills might limit their ability to use that list absent express consent from me. Another area that we're looking at is data security and breach notification. This is the one that has the most bills, as you can see from the chart, but also it's the one that is probably the most likely to get some consensus because everyone agrees we don't want data breaches. From there, we have divergent ideas in terms of how quickly we have to be told, who we have to tell, and what we have to do if a breach occurs. But everyone agrees we should probably have fewer breaches if we can avoid them. And then the final one, which we've seen just in the last year, are mobile device privacy issues. There were a lot of folks who were outraged to learn that when they gave up their personal information about their phones to things like Google Maps, that the Google, that the device knew where they were. Well, you've said to your device, I want you to tell me how to get from point A to point B, and I want you to find me at point A, but now I'm mad that you know I'm at point A. So there's a little more to that, obviously. There's a concern about what's being done with that information subsequently. But there have been a series of bills introduced on mobile device privacy as well. To give you a sense of what motivates our friends in Congress? Well, you'll see on this chart, there was a big breach that everybody heard about in April, and we knew for a while that Senator Kerry and Senator McCain were talking about getting a bill together, and mid-March we heard, yeah, something might happen soon. Well, just 10 days after that big breach, they introduced their bill, and they basically talked about that breach at their press conference where they said, we need to have better tabs on what's being done with information, because if this information wasn't being shared, this breach wouldn't have been so horrible. A similar bill was introduced just one day later. Then we have a couple more breaches in April, and then lo and behold, in May, the first half of May, there are five bills introduced. It was a busy May. So to just give you a general overview of some of these bills, I'm not going to go through them all, but I would like to share with you just the fact that the three breach notification data security bills that were introduced in the Senate Judiciary Committee have all been reported out of that committee. Now, all of those bills are Democrat-driven. None of them are bipartisan. They did not vote with any Republican support out of the committee, but they still got out of the committee. So what does that mean? Well, about a year ago, there was a data security bill that got out of committee, and they tried to fast-track it, is what it's called, and put it on the Senate calendar with very little debate and discussion because it had cleared committee. So something getting out of committee needs to be really paid attention to, because at any time you could see that moving towards becoming law. So these bills have a series of different things they address. The sort of least one is the Feinstein bill, which is about breach notification standards. So letting people know that their information may have gotten into the wrong hands. As we go further down, we've got bills that call for better data security. There's also the standards in there, and then safeguards. There are more bills on data security and breach notification. Senator Rockefeller is the chair of the Senate Commerce Committee, and that's important because as the chair, he has the ability to try to move his bill along, similar to what Senator Leahy did with his as the chair of the Judiciary Committee, and get it in position to be able to be fast-tracked or moved or attached to some other bill. So I always like to tell people we all grew up watching Schoolhouse Rock, and we learned how a bill becomes a law. But I think it's probably a better example to go back to a Simpsons episode where they talked about the paperclip rule. And that's where a small bill gets attached to a bigger bill that's moving, what we call a must-pass bill, and it just happens. And nobody even knows it was happening. And that's the concern we have, is that at the end of the year, when there's a big rush to get everything done, they'll just tack this on. And all of a sudden, you've got a whole bunch of new regulations that you weren't even thinking about. In the House, we've got some bills, too, and like I said, this is a bipartisan issue. So the chair of the Subcommittee on Commerce, Manufacturing, and Trade introduced her own data security breach notification bill. There was a lot of debate around her bill. She had a hearing on it, and there was discussion about how much time can elapse before you get notified that a breach has occurred of your information. And this all arose because of Sony. They were very upset because they felt like Sony sat on that information for too long. So the question was, is 48 hours enough time? Is 2 weeks enough time? What's reasonable? And from your perspective, you have to think about, well, how much time would you want to investigate, to figure out the scope of this breach, and who needs to be told? Because one of the things that we always talk about on the data security side and the breach notification is over-notification. If you got an email every single day about who might have possibly maybe gotten your information, and it might possibly maybe one day lead to you getting an email you didn't want, you'd get a whole lot of emails, most of them you didn't want. So these bills are very interesting, though. They do call for tighter standards. And they also call, and this is a big one for any of you that have large caches of information, they call for free data security or credit monitoring services. And that's a pretty big deal. If you think about how much you might have to pay per year or per month for each of your files that you have, you might want to think about those bills. Then we move on to privacy. And like I said, data security is one where we're able to sort of get our heads around and say that we all want to have more secure data. But what about privacy? What kinds of rights do we think consumers ought to have about their data? Well, Senator Rockefeller thinks that consumers ought to have the right to tell online folks not to track their information. And Dan will talk more about this in a bit, but what's interesting about Senator Rockefeller's bill is that he says consumers ought to have the ability to opt out, but I'm not really sure how that would work. So FTC, you go figure it out. Come up with a regime. This one also talks about collection from mobile devices. So you'll see on that Venn diagram we had earlier, it overlaps. Then Senators Kerry and McCain, as I talked about before, introduced this bill together. And they had opt-out mechanisms for data sharing. But one thing they didn't have, which was a big surprise to the industry, was they did not have a do not track requirement or an opt-out of tracking. They basically said that if you restrict how the information is used or shared down the line, it's okay to collect it. They come at it from the opposite direction of Senator Rockefeller, who says, well, if you can't collect it, no worries about who you share it with. In the House, we have a ton of bills. The important thing about these is that some are more supported than others, and some are introduced by folks who may have a little bit more ability to move their bills along. So as we talked about before, Markey and Barton introduced their Do Not Track Kids Act. They've both been very long advocates of these of privacy issues. The interesting thing about this bill is moving the age that you can't track all the way up to 18. So under COPPA, it goes to 13. But here we go to 18. Well, what does that mean for marketers for colleges? What does that mean for SAT prep? What does that mean for the 16-year-old mom who wants to get the diapers.com emails? You can't necessarily track. And so it creates a whole new regime for teenagers, not kids, teenagers. Some people may like that. Parents in the room may say, that's great. But this is a big change if this were to happen. Congresswoman Speer introduced several bills. She was very, very active on privacy and data security issues in California, so it's no surprise she's introduced quite a few. Most people don't think her bills are going to go too far. She's a Democrat from California in the House, probably not the biggest concern. I think one of the bigger ones is the bill introduced by Congressman Stearns. He had been the chair of the committee that Congressman Bono Mack is now the chair of, and he is very, very supportive of data security and privacy bills. He has introduced several. He also supports the others out there. He wants to get something done, which is always a good sign. If you want to get something done, it's a bad sign if you want to try to ride it out like we have the last several years. But a big, big change in his bill is that he's broadened who would be covered by this. And again, Dan may talk some more about this, but currently the FTC really doesn't have a whole lot of jurisdiction over 501c3s and nonprofits. Well, this bill specifically includes nonprofits. And then finally, just very quickly, we'll talk about mobile device privacy. As I said, people were very concerned to learn that you could find them. Simultaneously, there were some bills in Congress that would try to help law enforcement find you on your phone. So you right hand and left hand don't always talk to each other, but these are ones where they're trying to restrict collection and use of information. People feel like, and I know it happens to me all the time, you might get a privacy notice, but you ignore it because you just want to get your map. You know, so what do we do about that? How do we, at the point, at the real time, how do we address the fact that your information may be collected and shared? Or do we just tell you you can't collect and share it short of just this one transaction of telling me where I am? Well, then why would we have these free apps? You know, it's one of those things where people don't understand that these things cost money and something's got to pay for it. Your information really does have value. Back to our friends at Barnes & Noble, buying the Borders list. So how does this interplay with current law? Well, there are a lot of federal statutes that would retain jurisdiction where overlap occurs, and I think that's important to think about. If you are covered by Gramm-Leach-Bliley, for example, or if some of your activities are covered by Gramm-Leach-Bliley, you would want to look at what activities are covered by that and what activities would be covered by some of these new regimes. And so any of you who have credit card information, that kind of thing, fair credit reporting, and then as Joellen will talk about in detail later, anything health-related. Almost all of these bills are going to carve that out. So they're not trying to impose new privacy rules on that kind of information. They say that's probably enough, but for anything else. So really we're talking about marketing information. And then there are state statutes throughout. Most states have a data security regime. And a lot of folks are concerned that this will be a 51st cop on the block instead of one set of rules if there's not sufficient preemption. So that's another thing to look at in terms of interplay with current law, not just current federal law, but current state law. There are some states that want to go further than some of these bills. And the question is, will they be preempted from doing that?
So with that, I wanted to turn it over to Dan to talk about issues that have been going on with the administration and actions that they're taking and could take even in the absence of congressional action.
Good morning. This administration is very active in the privacy arena, and they are certainly supporting legislative activity. By this administration, I'm also including the independent agency that I deal with all the time, which is the Federal Trade Commission. The Federal Trade Commission, in fact, in my view, has really been the tip of the spear on a lot of privacy policy, privacy regulation, and of course, privacy enforcement. They really got into the game in the late 90s with the rise of the internet. Their first big breach case was in the mid-2000s, and they're very interesting agency because they are prosecutors, but they're also a think tank of sorts, and part of their role here has been to basically have a two-set punch of enforcement and policy. Last year, the Department of Commerce has also gotten into the privacy arena, I think, along with other agencies in the administration, basically in support of legislative activity. I think the bottom line here on all of this is whatever your odds are for legislation passing, if it doesn't pass, there's still going to be very active and strong policy and enforcement activity among the agencies. So let me turn to the FTC. Yeah, sure. But let me turn to the FTC on the policy front. This commission is highly, highly Hill-focused. The current chairman is a former Hill staffer, Chairman Leibowitz. He had a high-level position on Senate Judiciary. He has, subsequent to that, worked in the lobbying world, and it's something he really cares a lot about. He spends a lot of time thinking about. Last December, the agency came out with a very thick, very long, but to me somewhat surprising interim staff report on privacy recommendations. And it was surprising to me because even though it had a lot of soft recommendations, the one that got the most sort of press activity was Do Not Track, which I'll talk a little bit about. But also when you read through the report, it had many, many open questions. There was obviously a call from the staff to do a lot more work. They didn't really make strong recommendations. I think in part that's because the commission is not part of the unilateral executive branch. It's a five-member commission by statute. Two of the commissioners are Democrats, two are Republicans, and one is a so-called independent. So you have to have more consensus in an entity like that. But sort of the three main focuses of that report are what they called privacy by design, which I would say is just a very soft concept of incorporating these fair information practices into your everyday businesses. So that's going to be notice and access and, you know, transparency and reasonable security for data, and a sort of very soft, almost self-regulatory push to have people begin to start doing internal planning, have chief privacy officers, to think about what kind of data you have, what's sensitive, what's not, what your controls are, what you do if you have a breach. The FTC also focus on choice. I think as privacy professionals, we tend to think that choice is very important. However, as consumers, we actually, I think the empirical evidence shows that most people don't make a lot of choices about privacy. If they want to do something on the net and they want to sign up for a service, they just go and do it, which gets to the third piece of this, which is notice and access. The FTC, I think, has fairly recognized that notice provisions for most consumers are pretty meaningless. We as lawyers, we write these very long, very careful privacy notices, and that's a good thing that we do that for in situations when we have breaches. Consumers don't read them. They don't understand them. They're fairly meaningless, and the FTC has recognized that, and they don't know what to do, but they want a little more clear, concise, meaningful notice so people can have appropriate choice. There were some strong concurrences, which were actually dissents by the two Republican commissioners to the report and some of the suggestions in the report. I'll talk a little bit about the two bookends in a second. But despite these dissents by the Republican commissioners, the FTC has been pushing hard on the legislation. They've testified 9 times so far before the commission, and they have said that the final report will come out this fall or this winter. They say that about a lot of their reports. They come out several years later. Who knows? But that may happen. So what are the bookends of the FTC policy debate? I'm going to just put it into 3 buckets. One issue here is Europe. Those of you who have data in Europe and have to deal with the directive know that they have a very comprehensive, broad, highly regulatory system in Europe. We don't have that. What we have is we have specific statutes that deal with very specific, hopefully well-recognized problems. So credit reports, we have a statute for that. Financial information for financial institutions, we have Gramm-Leach-Bliley for that. For children information, we have COPPA. Europe is very different. Some people think we should be more European in many things, including our privacy debate. The sort of the Republic-leaning side of the commission says, wait a second, we're not sure if we know enough about all the implications of having a comprehensive privacy, one size fits all. Commissioner Roche, who's one of the Republicans, has suggested that the FTC do what's called a 6B study, which would mean that they would issue hundreds of CIDs or subpoenas to all sorts of industries and impose some costs on all of you and try and figure this out. For those of you who are worried about overreaching on privacy regulation, that may be a good thing because that will take years. We'll see if that happens. Another big sort of bookend of the debate is this issue of the fair information practices versus a harm-based standard. I mean, the concept of notice, choice, transparency, access, data security, they're nice principles to articulate, but they're hard to put into practice, especially when you get into all the permeations of data. I mean, you may care a lot about what you tell your doctor, what type of Kleenex you buy at the supermarket, you might not care at all about. You know, your doctor's information you might want access to, the information that someone is tracking for purposes of your shopping experience at a supermarket, do you really need access to that? Some people are advocating that really what we should do is focus our privacy regulation on things where people are really harmed, like financial information and identity theft. And then there's do not track. Do not track is, again, one of these concepts that sounds good in practice, but no one really understands how it would work on the internet. There's a lot of different layers of technology on the internet. There are some obvious industry solutions that people are pushing. Sort of these one-click do not track me items, whether they're actually working or working in a way consumers think they're working is an open question. So finally, because I live in a day-to-day FTC world, one of the things that I've been looking at in their world of legislation is what the FTC would look like in a new regime with a new privacy regulation. What's really interesting to me is the commission is an entity that has really broad powers to make up what the law is. Their sort of fundamental organic statute basically says unfair and deceptive practices are prohibited. We the agency, in essence, federal common law sense, make up what that means, but for the most part, all we can do is hit you with a consent order. A lot of the legislation, or at least some of it, would allow them to engage in rulemaking, in APA rulemaking, which they don't have now for their general powers, which would be a huge change for the commission. They would be able to impose civil penalties for violations of Section 5. That would be a huge game changer. It would basically make FTC violations potentially very, very expensive. And finally, they would have independent authority to go into federal court. Right now, they don't have that. They have to go to DOJ first for purposes of getting money. So all of that really means that they would have a much bigger stick. Just really quickly on the Department of Commerce, last year they got into this game. They issued a report too. It just happens that the person who's leading this at Commerce is Cam Carey. He is the brother of Senator Carey. There might be some coincidence there. It might be something else. I'll turn it back to you, Jamie.
I was just going to ask a question of you guys. With all of this activity and all of the focus on privacy, can you handicap whether something is actually going to happen? And if so, what might that look like?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing to keep in mind is there really are so many cooks in the kitchen and there's so many folks grabbing for jurisdiction that we may see some paralysis as we've seen in the past couple of years. But what I always warn people is we're one data breach away, we're one huge breach, and we've seen so many this past year. I do think that if there is an opportunity to slip something in, there may be a data security or breach notification bill that's out there. But there is this general paralysis, which is helping keep some of this back. And like I said, there's this bipartisan support. So we've got these signs. The other thing that Dan mentioned just now, I don't think we should take lightly the fact that Department of Commerce is so closely tied to one of the senators leading the charge on privacy issues. And they've already called on Department of Commerce to do more because Congress maybe can't act. And so they're sending these signals. And the most important thing in my mind is the fact that you're getting some very similar signals from the other side of the aisle. So if you're the administration, you say, well, hold on a second now. You've got Joe Barton asking me to do this. Maybe I should do it. You've got, Republican House cover for the things that you at the Department of Commerce or you at the FTC have been wanting to do anyway. So go out, try it, see what you can get done.
Congress has been active in this space for quite some time, and while there have been other statutes that have been enacted, I think there are two that really stand out, the HIPAA and high tech, in terms of examples of what a regulatory regime would look like. While these are focused on the healthcare sector, I think there are lessons that can be learned and extrapolated in terms of what a regulatory regime would look like in other areas, and Joe Ellen's going to walk us through on that.
Good morning. I'm going to move around a bit, make sure you're all awake and have had your coffee. I'm going to tell you some tales kind of from the dark side. This is what it looks like when the rubber hits the road. In the health sector, we've had extensive privacy and data security regulation for quite some time. It's not theoretical. It's not interim staff reports. It's not bills that are pending. It's happening, and it's happening now. Now, many of you may not know much about HIPAA beyond the notice that your doctor has to give you under HIPAA, so I'll give you a really quick 30-second primer on what HIPAA is and why it matters and what it does with respect to concepts like notice and choice and what it means. So HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, which I might add is about the administrative simplification provisions are about this thick, and its implementing regulations create a really complex web of privacy and security regulation. And it's layered atop state requirements. Anything that's more stringent at the state level is going to continue to apply. So you've got this really complex scheme that was enacted in 1996. It was implemented through rulemakings primarily in 2003 and 2005. They took effect. And those rulemakings take up an entire shelf in my office. So the FTC, HHS, different agencies, of course, but when you get this teeny tiny little law, you can sometimes find yourself in a whole world of regulatory hurt. The early focus of HIPAA, of enforcement, was really on voluntary compliance. There was a lot of education. It was a complaint-driven process. And then, boom, Stimulus Act. Everything changed. You have a big piece of legislation. This may sound familiar if you were paying attention earlier. A big piece of legislation that's moving. The HITECH Act, which covered health information privacy changes, totally overhauled the HIPAA regime, suddenly passed. Now, parts of this act were so complicated with the changes that they made, for example, to the what health entities could do with marketing information, for example. It looked like the rule against perpetuities to me, for those lawyers who remember that. It's like, there's no way this thing will pass. It's so complicated. They wouldn't know what to do with it. Guess what? It passed. So what did it do? Suddenly we have more entities that need to deal with HIPAA. It should be on a lot more folks' radar than it was. Increased penalties, and they're actually assessing them. There's a penalty that's been assessed. There's settlements. There are millions of dollars at stake here now, whereas before it was a hypothetical risk of maybe a few thousand. We have new enforcement mechanisms. The state attorneys general are getting into the act. We have audits. Yes, audits. KPMG has been hired. $9.2 million contract. Congratulations. Your number could come up. And we have breach notification requirements. So basically, we started out in 1996, and here we are in 2011 in a whole new era of enforcement. So really quickly, HIPAA basics, what you need to know for my presentation to make sense. Who needs to comply with HIPAA? HIPAA applies to what we call a covered entity, which is a health plan, could be a self-insured group health plan that any major corporation has. It's covered healthcare providers. It's healthcare clearinghouses. Business associates, this is a good example. And many of you in this room may actually be business associates, and many of you may not even know that. HIPAA, in the original form, applied to business associates only to the extent that they had a contract with a covered entity. A business associate's a helper. It's someone who provides a service for or on behalf of a covered entity that involves getting access to, using, disclosing data. They get the goodies, right? So HHS said, if you want to get the goodies, you got to enter into a contract saying you're not going to do anything naughty with the goodies. And basically your obligations, maybe you didn't negotiate that well, or maybe you had a really strong business associate and you had to indemnify if something bad happened, like a major breach, but your obligations as a business associate were limited to the four corners of that contract. Well, party's over. We now have the HITECH Act. Business associates are going to be in the same shoes as the covered entities. So they're going to have the same risk of penalties as these covered entities when they have a breach. And we actually just had a major breach, which you may have read about in the newspapers, out at Stanford, where it wasn't really anything necessarily arguably that Stanford did. It was a business associate, a vendor that they trusted with their goodies that did something that they shouldn't have. Oh, posted it all on the internet. And now we're going to see what happens. Who's HHS going to go after? There's already been a civil suit. It's getting kind of messy. This is what it looks like when the rubber hits the road. So what information is covered? Under the privacy bills that Francine mentioned earlier, this is a big question to ask. Not only should we be looking at these bills and say, does this bill apply to me? But you should also look at what data do I have that would be subject to this bill? Protected health information. Oh, you'd think, oh, it's just what's in your clinical record. It's just what they use to make decisions about you. Oh, no, it can include all of the demographic information. Your date of birth can be protected health information. HIPAA doesn't care if your information was posted on a billboard somewhere. If it came out of your health record, if someone was dipping into your plan files, it's protected health information and needs to be handled accordingly. The basic tenet of HIPAA, the thou shalt not of the HIPAA world, is you cannot use or disclose this sensitive information, this PHI, without authorization from the individual, so you've got the choice concept here, without authorization unless you're expressly permitted or required to do so. And there is this crazy regulatory regime of when you are and are not required to do so. It sounds kind of simple at the beginning. Well, for treatment purposes, you can share. For payment purposes, you can share. For healthcare operations, which is kind of running your back office, you can share. But when the rubber hits the road, it gets kind of complicated. And similarly, there are a lot of exceptions. There are buckets where you're allowed to share. For example, you can disclose as required by law. But what I found in practicing HIPAA for the past, I don't know, 10, however many years, I'm dating myself here, these buckets aren't necessarily placed right next to each other. So you've got all these exceptions under 164.512, and it sounds great. Yes, you can disclose in court proceedings, and yes, you can disclose here, and yes, you can disclose there, but the drops tend to fall between the buckets sometimes, and you'll disclose information in a way that you really thought would be fine, but it's not. And then we have the individual rights concept, and this is where you get the what Dan would say, the consumer's rights. What rights do I have to my data? This is where you can access your record. This is where you can amend your record. And some of these rights are going to be harm-based. Like, you really need to make sure that what's in your health information is accurate, that it's true, that they operate on the right leg, that they know that you're allergic to penicillin, that they know all these things about you, right? That's harm-based. Similarly, if they charge you the wrong amount because they have your payment information wrong, harm-based. But some of them are privacy for privacy's sake. The accounting part of this, for example, disclosing information, how your information gets disclosed downstream and knowing what happens there, that's really just so you know, it's a privacy for privacy's sake provision. And then the security rule, basically, I can sum that one up. It's not that different from what the FTC's approach is. The security rule is the, kind of the flip side to privacy. Basically, you need to have administrative, physical, and technical safeguards to make sure your goodies stay safe. And the security rule, for some reason, the privacy rule, I've got that whole shelf full. The security rule is about, I don't know, Yothic with a preamble. And I don't know why, but it reads like a novel. So for those of you, or at least to me, it reads like a novel. So for those of you who are considering taking steps to protect your goodies, whatever your goodies may be, it's not a bad read. Not only can we learn from how things have evolved in the health sector, but there's also a lot of good guidance out there. Just because you're not subject to HIPAA doesn't mean that if you have sensitive information, you shouldn't be surfing on their site, seeing what forms are there, seeing what guidance is there, and making it work for you. Now, the breach notification rule. This was a national breach notification rule. It applies on top of all of the state regimes. And we have what I like to call the wall of shame. Congratulations, if you had a breach that involved more than 500 people, you could be here. Your name, the state you're in, the number of individuals affected, the date of the breach, the type of the breach. Congratulations, you're famous. Now, a lot of folks outside the health sector don't know this is there. It's right on the OCR website. If you have sensitive data, go take a look. See where the risks are. Look at the types of breaches that are happening, the location of those breaches. Update your policies and procedures. Learn from others' mistakes. Well, what happens when you make those mistakes? Well, I said we have a heightened enforcement action. We have new tools. We also have more money on the line. And these penalties, these settlements, guess where all that money goes? Per the statute, goes right back to OCR, Office for Civil Rights. So they can enforce and hopefully educate us also. They promised they would have some more resources for outreach and all that. But basically, we could have a lovely self-sustaining ecosystem where they go, what, that you have to post your breach when you have a really bad one. And then they come and they investigate. And they've assured us, Susan McAndrew, who's one of the big wigs over at OCR, has assured us that they're actually investigating everyone who comes up, or at least looking into everything that comes up on the wall of shame. And then they figure out which ones are the egregious ones. They enter into a settlement. They get that money. They put it back in the coffers. They go investigate more. You could see this cycle. This is what it looks like when you're regulated. Well, it doesn't look like it over there. It looks like it over here. So we've had some recent enforcement actions, as you may have heard. And I'll walk through these really quickly. You'll notice the dates start in 2008. We got our statute in 1996. We had some lag time. They gave us some time to kind of get used to things. But it's really rolling now, folks. Providence Health and Human Services, Providence Health and Services, I view this one as we're just getting warmed up here, guys. You really should have thought twice about not encrypting all that data that you left in laptops in someone's car. The number of breaches that involve data that's stolen out of unsecured devices from cars, you'd think there are people just driving on I-95 and parking their car at rest stops with data everywhere, with signs saying, hey, data in this car. because it really seems like it happens all the time. They got off easy, $100,000 settlement, corrective action plan. And HHS corrective action plans are much kinder and friendlier than the ones that Dan's friends like to put people under. We're generally like in the 3 to 5 year range. We had a 2 year one. Those FTC folks, they like 20 years. And that's what CVS and Rite Aid found out when they had a breach and got investigated by not just OCR, but FTC too. They teamed up. Isn't that great? Naughty Naughty shouldn't have been throwing away those pill containers with everyone's information on them from all those prescriptions in an open dumpster where some media could perhaps go dumpster diving. So that was a $2.25 million settlement that HHS used to kind of underscore the fact that the High Tech Act had just passed. That one got announced on the eve of the passage of the High Tech Act in 2009. And then Rite Aid, don't you pay attention. Same thing happened to them. They had the pill bottles going out in the dumpster. Similar circumstances. We just published a big notice of proposed rulemaking under the High Tech Act. Ta-da! $1 million settlement. Management services organization. So you're here. You think we have a False Claims Act problem. Didn't think we'd be looking at your HIPAA compliance. Guess what? We were. $35,000 settlement and 2 year cap. Then we have Signet Health. And this is where individual rights, which are like holy in the healthcare sector, individual rights, what that person can do with their information, their right to get access to their records and a copy of their records, really sacred. So these folks actually decided not only would they not cooperate with the investigation, but they weren't giving people access to their records when they requested it. And they got hit with the first penalty, and it was $4.3 million. Mass General, this is the one that, for me, I call it the O for Love of God breach, because I could see this happening to anyone I know. Someone, a diligent employee, left a pile of files on the subway train while commuting, and they happened to contain records from the infectious disease department. It's awful. But you could see how an organization, even with good policies and procedures, perhaps that could happen, and it wasn't like you had a bad actor, there wasn't a hacker. There wasn't anything like, you know, malintent was just not there. Perhaps someone didn't think things through all the way, but, you know, $1 million settlement. And then UCLA, this is one that I like to reference because people are curious. Everyone is curious, and you need to make sure that you have controls to make sure that people aren't snooping around in the goodies. A lot of celebrities go to hospitals like UCLA. And people were, you know, Octomom, oh, I'd like to see what's going on there. Or Farrah Fawcett, I'd like to see what's going on there. And those folks, you know, shouldn't be doing that. And it's amazing to see where people get tripped up. So basically, we got our statute, we got our regulations, they overhauled them, and then voila, here we are. So that's the federal enforcement actions. Then the state attorneys general, they weren't going to be left out. They got some skin in the game under the High Tech Act, and we've actually seen some enforcement actions there. Connecticut, Blumenthal, Francine's friend, was the first of the state attorneys general to bring an enforcement action under the new High Tech Authority. It was, again, involving stolen, unencrypted information. It spawned one out of Vermont also. Blumenthal had higher aspirations. He's now in the Senate where he, I believe, works on privacy. Yeah, the audit program. As if it wasn't bad enough, you get this complex regulatory regime, you have to deal with compliance and getting everybody educated and everybody trained, and you have to deal with the breaches because they happen, people are human, mistakes happen. Then you have to deal with, you know, the investigation and all that. We now have an audit program that's getting rolled out. It was announced in the High Tech Act, became law, and they just in July hired our good friends at KPMG in a $9.2 million contract that runs just for 1 year to audit, I think it's about 150 covered entities. Will they reach business associates too? I don't know. What are they going to do when they get there? Well, the new head of OCR just said last week, well, yeah, of course, our main goal, he's interviewed, our main goal isn't to find things and then hit people with penalties. That's not what this is about. But guess what? If we get there and we find things that are really egregious, you're going to find yourself hit with penalties. So it's really kind of, frankly, ugly out there. And once you get regulated, once the laws that Francine talks about come to pass, and once the regulatory authorities get involved, you could find yourself really having a major burden of compliance. You're going to have to stop and think under all of these laws, whether it's HIPAA or other ones, you're going to have to stop and think, you know, am I covered by this? Does this apply to me? And that may sound simple, but I could tell you from the HIPAA context, I get calls all the time from clients. you know, it just occurred to us that we might be a covered entity because we pay for something that actually qualifies as healthcare, even though I'm not a hospital, I'm not a this, I'm some quirky entity. Or I just discovered that we have a business line that contracts with covered entities and they have some information. I don't know if they're technically a business associate because it's a bit of a complex analysis. So you could have a burden of compliance there just figuring out and taking on the dedication of resources, potentially hiring outside counsel to figure out if you need to comply. Then you need to either develop or update your written policies and procedures. And I've had clients call me up and say, I say to them, well, what does your policy say on that? Say, oh, let me get the shrink wrap off. I'll take a look. No. You have to actually have living and breathing policies and procedures. And then you need to make sure that they're tailored to your organization. You have to actually think, what are my data flows? What are my risks? The risk assessments required under the security rule, not under privacy, but you should stop and think, what privacy risks do I have and how do I deal with them in my policies and procedures? You should be reevaluating these. You shouldn't just leave them on a shelf to collect dust. They should be reevaluated on a regular basis, and especially when you have an incident, when you find out that through your internal audit mechanisms that you have outlier access to records, that folks are peeking in things, well, talk to your IT guys. What can we do about this? Could we just have someone have to hit enter an extra time when we know we have a sensitive record? What could we do that wouldn't interfere with providing care, but that would help us not have this problem? And you have to ensure compliance in practice. Having great policies and procedures that have thought of absolutely everything gets you nowhere if people aren't actually making them come to life. So you have to train people. You have to do some thoughtful auditing internally to see what's actually happening. And then you have to have, unfortunately, a game plan because bad things happen to even good people. Data breaches happen, even to people who are careful and thoughtful. One of the best HIPAA presentations I ever heard was from a woman who was running a Medicaid organization that endured a breach on her watch that affected millions of indigent people in her state. And she got a call that this had happened, and then 5 minutes later, she got a second call that the press wanted to talk to her. And she said she just turned white as a sheet because this is in the early days of data breaches. And she was like, I have 5 minutes to get myself camera ready. Wow. So you need to make sure you have someone in the health sector. Who's your front person? Who's going to handle all this? Will that person be ready? Will they know what they need to know? Have they been briefed by your PR team? This is what it means to live in the land of the regulated. You need to be prepared for the investigators to come. Your number could come up. You could be subject to a HIPAA audit. Are you ready? Are your policies and procedures up to snuff, or have you perhaps not looked at them since, 2003 when you wrote them? So there's a lot to be learned from the health sector. I'd encourage folks to stop and think, am I in this bucket already? Because a lot of folks haven't really examined their operations. I would also encourage those of you, even if you determined that you're not subject to HIPAA, that you don't have to deal with this, take advantage and learn from the mistakes of those in the health sector, and also use the HHS guidance. Think about it, business associate agreement. That's that agreement I mentioned before, where you basically promise not to do anything naughty with the goodies of the folks that trusted you with them. Well, if you call it an information use and disclosure agreement, it might be great in other contexts too. They've really thought about what contractual provisions you'd want to have in place to keep data safe. So I'd encourage all of you, even if you're not subject to HIPAA, to spend some time surfing through the materials that are available.
Thanks, Joellen. Dan, this is obviously a very complex, very prescriptive world in the HHS. How does it compare with the folks over at FTC?
Well, this is my tales from the dark side part of the presentation. The FTC, at least the FTC as it exists today, is still in a different world. Joellen lives in a world of rules. I, for the most part, with my FTC practice, live in a rule of standards that most of the FTC enforcement is brought under Section 5. Again, Section 5 is this very broad statute that prohibits deceptive and unfair trade practices. The FTC, through its enforcement actions, basically builds on what that means. They also have some specific statutes like GLB that they enforce. And if you want to think about what the FTC is doing and put it in buckets, those are three really, I think, useful buckets to think about. They have their privacy promise cases, which is you have a privacy policy. You think it's a policy. If you have a breach or some other alleged misuse or controversial use of the data, the FTC treats it as a one-sided contract. You have your data security cases, which the FTC generally enforces both under its privacy promise theories, but also as under an unfairness theory, that if you don't take reasonable steps to protect sensitive data, that that is an unfair trade practice. Notably, both of these two buckets are really consent decree type actions, that to this date, no one has litigated an FTC case under a privacy promise or a data security. If that's you, I'll be willing to help you. But that hasn't happened yet. The other bucket is specific statutory authority for the FTC or trade regulation rules, the actual regulations that the FTC promulgates under their Magnuson-Moss authority, which is very difficult, very complicated. I'm just going to talk about COPPA a little in this presentation because that's both subject of legislative activity as well as regulatory activity. I also think it's interesting to think about what they're not doing. They're not doing what I would think of as their bread and butter cases, the big data breaches involving retailers. They haven't done one of those in a long time. That's not to say that those aren't bad situations for those people. There are both a lot of private lawyers who are bringing class actions, albeit unsuccessfully so far, but they are trying to figure out a theory that is going to allow them to successfully bring cases and get fees. And then you also just have your contractual relationships with your business partners. Those of you who deal with financial information are probably pretty familiar with the CPI standards. If you have a big data breach, you're either going to be threatened with lawsuits or you're going to get lawsuits with, for example, your credit card network. So you have to think about those. The FTC is not bringing identity theft cases. Identity theft is the number one consumer issue in privacy. It's what everybody cares about. FTC is powerless to do anything about this. What they do is rather than go against the identity thieves, they go against the people the thieves steal from you, your clients, who have the data. They're not doing brick and mortar. I mean, the internet is where most of the action is. I think it's new, it's somewhat interesting to the FTC, you can collect more data, you can use more data, maybe it's more susceptible to data breaches. And then right now we're not seeing FTC enforcement for what I'll just generally call nonprofits. That's because the FTC doesn't have statutory authority over them right now, but that may change. So let me just briefly talk about some notable cases in these three buckets. Oh, thank you. First of all, privacy promise cases. Twitter had, in essence, a breach where they had some very lax, according to the FTC, internal password control. Some hackers got into their system. They took administrative control of it. President Obama sent a tweet for a sweepstake for gasoline. Okay, maybe it wasn't him, but it was someone who was laughing very hard about that. Apparently, the FTC did not like that, and they went and looked at Twitter's privacy policy and said, you said that wouldn't happen, more or less, so we're going to get you to enter into a consent decree, which Twitter did. And basically, for those of you who are familiar with the safeguards rule under GLB, that's sort of the mainstay privacy relief that the FTC enforces on people in consent decrees, which is basically a requirement that you have a privacy professional, a plan in place, that you assess risks, that you engage in audits, all these things you get under a regulatory regime like the healthcare area, and that is really where the FTC would like the world to go. There's the Borders bankruptcy situation. I suspect that many, if not most of you, got that email from Barnes & Noble basically asking you to opt out if you don't want them to use your data. Borders is liquidating probably one of the most valuable sets of assets they have left. is this customer list and information. Someone who had written the original Borders privacy policy didn't think about them liquidating. Not surprising. They actually later on had changed it to allow for organic changes like that. The bankruptcy laws now have some privacy provisions in them, so there was actually a privacy ombudsman appointed to oversee the data. It held up the sale of the assets. Obviously, the bankruptcy judge, in my view, did the reasonable thing, which was to allow Barnes & Noble to get this valuable asset so the creditors could get a little more money, and there's an opportunity to opt out. But I think the lesson for you is when you look at your privacy policies, which, let's face it, most of your clients' customers are not, you should put a lot of flexibility in there for yourself because you just never know what's going to happen. Google Buzz, this is another privacy case. Google was highly criticized when they rolled out their social networking service and they took a bunch of information that people had signed up for other services. This is basically a misuse case. You said you were going to use the data for one thing and now you're using another. Query whether Google could have saved itself by having a privacy policy that was much more broad and flexible. What would consumers do in that situation? From the FTC perspective, this was precedent setting in two ways. Again, in this case, they imposed a safeguard-like requirement by a consent decree to have a privacy, chief information officer and a plan in place and an assessment and audits, all these things that people get stuck with when they have breaches. This was unusual because it was not a breach case. This was just a simple misuse case, and this is really the FTC's way of trying to tell you that you should engage in their privacy by design. That is, think about what you're doing with the data, think about the flows, think about what could go wrong. It also is the first case that alleged a substantive violation of the US EU safe harbor framework. Basically, in order to get PII or personal information from Europe, for those of you whose clients are international, a lot of times you have to go through this self-certification on the framework because Europe doesn't think that the U.S. laws are strict enough. Google had done that, but was alleged not to have lived up to the statements or the promises they made in its certification. Another bucket is notable data security cases, and I put three here, but I'm going to really talk about them in two buckets. Settlement One Credit was a case in which a credit report consolidator had its customers hacked. So this is like the concept of the business associates, where you're doing business with someone who you're giving data to, and they're not safe enough. They do something that is not secure, and you pay the price for this. So that again is where the FTC would like the world to go. For legal purposes, I think that you have to read this case thinking about the Fair Credit Report obligations, the Gramm-Leach-Bliley obligations, and the safeguard rule. I think if we were dealing with data other than credit reports, you would not have gotten this result here, though that is obviously where the FTC would like to go. Compare that to the Ceridian and the Lookout Services breach. These are basically companies that are service providers to businesses. They do back office work. One does payroll, another does immigration, citizenship verification. Both had either breaches or inappropriate access by an employee. These cases, to me, show that the FTC is not just simply looking at consumers. They're trying to tell you that they're also going to think about other types of data, whether it's employee data or some other set of data that you collect. And then finally, COPPA. I mean, as you heard, COPPA is under legislative review. It's also under regulatory review. It was the rule that's enforced by the FTC under COPPA was first passed in 2000. It has not been changed. The FTC is looking at it to see if they can update it for purposes of the new technology. There's been, you know, online gaming, for example, is really come alive in the last decade. Right now, they are not proposing that they move COPPA to 18. Very controversial. I think for the most part that what they're trying to do here are basic incremental steps, basically expanding the definition of personal information to reflect what children are really doing online, some more flexibility for parental consent, some safeguards for vendors, and audits for the safe harbor organizations. That's the organizations that oversee sort of basic COPPA compliance. They brought two recent cases in this area. I'm not really going to go into detail other than to say that these are typical FTC civil penalty cases. One is the first mobile app case. The FTC is always looking for the next big thing. So if you're reading about your client's technology in the paper a lot, like cloud computing, if you're getting into cloud computing, which I think a lot of people are, there's going to be a cloud computing case. It's coming. Playdom is sort of an interesting, I think, legal compliance issue case because this was a company that was acquired by Disney. Disney may or may not have done appropriate due diligence in doing the deal, but Playdom, its privacy COPPA policies were not sufficient. And ultimately, Playdom / Disney took a judgment here and paid a civil penalty.
As we get to this part of the presentation, I really would like to ask my panelists for some takeaways for you guys and gals that are in the audience. Washington's obviously very active in this space, and whether it's new legislation, new regulation, or an expanded enforcement agenda, what are the implications and how might these guys be impacted?
Sure. Well, you will be impacted in different ways depending upon what actually passes or is implemented by the FTC and Department of Commerce. But the one thing to really keep in mind is that things may change, and they may change quickly. As Joellen said, on the High Tech Act, nobody thought that would ever get passed, and then it got passed, and all of a sudden you're under this whole new regime. So what could this regime mean for you? Increased financial or litigation liability, and that's a really big one. The ability for civil actions to be brought against you. Some of these bills allow for a private right of action. So for the plaintiff's attorneys in the room, that's great. For the rest of us, questionable. Also, huge costs in terms of the free credit monitoring, credit scores, that kind of thing. There's also compliance costs, just the cost of notice, the cost of, and this is a big one for those who both have online and retail point of sale activities. What kind of notice do you have to give before you collect my information at a cash register? Do I have to read it? Do I have to sign something? That's going to slow things down a lot. You swipe your card at the McDonald's drive-thru, you have to click something and say, well, yes, I know you might share my information with my credit card company, but I want you to do that because I want them to tell you that it's okay to pay. That kind of thing can really slow down commerce. And for you, it can increase your compliance costs. And in an environment where you're hearing pushback from the Republican side of the aisle of too much regulation slowing down business, you're not hearing that when we talk about data security and privacy. None of those folks feel like you're regulated too much just yet. And I think that's a big concern, is that there are people gunning for you. And like we talked about before, if they can't do it legislatively, they're going to put some pressure on the administration to try to move some of this forward. And then finally, there's the reputation concerns. Right now, there are no rules, so none of you are necessarily breaking them in the eyes of some folks. If there are rules and you are breaking them, your reputation could be even further harmed. But I'll tell you right now, Sony's reputation has been hurt simply by the information about a breach. Whether or not they violated any laws by letting that breach occur is not as relevant to the parent who may be thinking about buying a PlayStation.
So how do we stay out ahead of this coming new regime?
Well, One of the most important things, I think, is to take a good hard look at some of these proposals, see what you can live with and what you can't live with, and what it might mean to you. We've got some clients who knew when they read various bills, you know, HIPAA, for example, that this wouldn't apply to them. They knew they were carved out. They knew it wouldn't apply. Well, it wasn't all that clear to the regulators, and they spent a lot of time and a lot of money having to make it clear after the fact that they weren't covered. Well, they got wise to that, and now they're working with a lot of the members of Congress to make sure that it's clear that they're not covered by some of these privacy and data security bills on the front end. And so I would encourage people, take a look at these bills, see if what's happening in them is an unintended consequence. You're being swept into a regime that they didn't mean to sweep you into. They don't understand the flow of data or the necessity of that flow of data and why you've got to be able to share it. Well, help them understand it. And if they didn't mean to drag you in, they may actually be willing to take you out.
And I would add that while we don't have any of these comprehensive regimes in place right now, there are laws that do govern privacy data protection that are out there. Our friends at HHS OCR did us the kind favor of compiling a nice chart of federal laws that apply already. And they're very sector specific, they're very data specific, but they're out there. There are also a lot of state laws out there. So I would recommend that folks take stock of their data flows. Know what data you have. I've dealt with some clients that are major companies, and my first question when they ask me to help them with compliance is, well, what data do you have? And they say, well, we don't really know. I guess we have this, I guess we have that. And folks don't really know because it's spread throughout their organization. Historically, it hasn't really been, frankly, that much of an issue to find out what type of individually identifiable data you have. So know your flows. Figure out which are the obvious contenders, what laws already apply. Look ahead, see what's coming down the pike, and then think about your actual risks. Just because a law doesn't necessarily apply, there isn't something that squarely addresses your situation, doesn't mean someone can't sue you, for example, for a tort, invasion of privacy. You can still have a lot of headaches and damage to your reputation, as Francine was saying, even where there isn't a specific legal requirement, Section 164.5-something, that you can point to that was violated. So know your flows. Think hard about your risks and take steps to have policies and procedures that are real, that are enforced, that folks are trained in, that are updated, that are live, that address those risks.
I think another key thing to take away is that, as was demonstrated by the sale of all of that information from Borders to Barnes & Noble, information does have value, and therefore it's incumbent upon you to protect that information and to do that now before Congress tells you how to do it.
And I would just add, I think there's a lot of opportunities for those of you who are really in the data world. It's really important for your clients' business operations that there are self-regulatory organizations, mm-hmm. there are trade associations, there are opportunities to affect this legislative debate. There are opportunities at the FTC to affect the FTC's activities and their policy when there are rulemakings or simply the FTC does these pseudo rulemakings where they issue reports. It's not regulations, but people provide comments. That's an opportunity to think about what's going on in Washington and how it might affect your business, and an opportunity to speak up and have an effect on what comes out of the sausage making operation that's Washington D.C.
And with that, we'll open it up to any questions folks might have. Yes, Marcy.
Dan, you mentioned cloud computing. That was a question that's been on my mind since Francine's presentation. With all these 18 bills, they seem to be focused mostly on marketers and retailers. Is anybody focusing on that? In other words, is there an analog to the business associate regulation in the HIPAA world? Is anyone thinking about that?
You know, some of them touch on it because they're so very broad, and they would discuss sharing and the flow of information. And so you've got this requirement that you let people know where you may share it. And so if you're going to put it in the cloud, you may have to have that in your privacy policy. There's also another regime on cybersecurity, which is proceeding down a probably faster path because they see that as a national security issue. And that may be somewhere where both cloud computing and more of the data security and privacy stuff could get tacked on at the last minute.
So you're saying actual, because I'm always fighting with the cloud vendors about liability. They're like, I'm in financial services, I'm regulated. They're like, well, we're not subject to your regulations. I'm like, yeah, but if there's a breach, the reputational risk and the fines will be imputed to me. And even if you're indemnified for the fine, it's not much of a penalty.
Yeah, and since you're calling them a third-party vendor, I think that's important to look at. I know in Congressman Stern's bill, for example, there's specific discussion of third-party vendors and their obligations. And the obligation will flow. If you get the information, you got the obligation.
I mean, if you are dealing with financial information and you're subject to GLB, then you're subject to the safeguards rule, and you're going to have to impose contractually on the people you're giving the financial information the safeguards.
And that doesn't give me a warm and fuzzy at the end of the day.
No, and the thing is,
it's only contract.
And it's a regulatory regime that you're probably pretty comfortable with, but it's the other people who are not dealing with financial data. That's where the FTC wants to go. They want to force you as the person collecting the data to contractually force your partners, your service providers, to engage in, you know, higher data practices, whatever they may be. And then they're going to hold both you and them liable. So either your clients collect the data, or your clients are processing the data, or your clients are holding the data. The FTC wants to be able to get all of you.
And this is where the health sector gives us a little bit of a crystal ball, because we started out with the business associates just needing to have contracts, and then we got the High Tech Act where there's direct liability. And I have taken what is called a business associate agreement with all those terms about how you can use and disclose data, the safeguards you need to have, restyled it in information use and disclosure agreement, and use it outside the health space, because basically someone already sat down and thought through all the terms that you need to have to be protected. And I also generally recommend that clients do those business associate agreements before they sign the service agreement. Before I sign on with you, make sure that you're going to have all these data practices. And I found sometimes, unfortunately, those data agreements can be thicker than the actual service agreement.
Any other questions? I'll turn it to my panelists if they've got any concluding remarks. Oh, sorry, yes.
Really a comment about the legislative activity as one who's not in any of the specifically regulated areas, just has products that we like to sell and market. Mm-hmm. I have always been of the view that a national regulation that preempts, that tells us what we can do and what we can't do, would, even if it's stricter than much of the current regime, would be very useful. Third-party providers would learn to be compliant with it, and we'd be able to act with less uncertainty and perhaps also more care. I think that would be, in my view, that would be a goal of advocacy as opposed to stopping.
Yep. No, absolutely, and you're not alone in that. There are quite a few folks out there that have been putting forth their own proposals on data security and privacy. I work with some clients who have tried to put together what would be their ideal law. The problem is often you find that the consumer advocates are not satisfied. So with the Kerry-McCain bill, which was really the product of compromise, nobody was happy, but I think the consumer groups were actually less happy than the folks who are actually marketing and you know, going to be restricted by this. But the biggest concern you should have is to make sure that that preemption is ironclad, because sometimes it's not quite as far as we need it to go, and then you've got a 51st cop on the block instead of one set of rules. But I think you're not alone. The bulk of the industry believes that one set of rules, even if they were California's rules, would probably be better than what you got right now.
Yeah, I guess I'd like to have a little dissent on that because I think it makes sense for things like data breach notification. I mean, right now when we deal with a data breach, we have a big binder of all the state laws and a checklist, and you pull it out, and the laws have enough variation that you have to go through them one by one. Now maybe when you decide that you have to do a notification in California, you do a notification everywhere. I mean, people make that decision. You do the lowest common denominator, but I can see where preemption will work. The problem with the one-size-fits-all privacy law is the advocates, the privacy advocates, want things like access. Now, in fair credit reporting, if someone puts on your credit report incorrectly that you filed for bankruptcy, that's going to have a real effect on you. And you should get access to do that to your credit report so you can fix that problem. Access to your shopping data about what type of Kleenex you buy, that would be really difficult and expensive, and there's lots of, you know, lots of layers and lots of service providers, and should you be able to get access from the service providers, and what would that really look like, and would consumers really actually do that, or opt in, opt out? That's one of the big debates here, which is Congress or some of these legislative proposals want people to have the ability to have to opt in if the data is sensitive. Well, if you decide that you're marketing to people and you're marketing certain products that are health related and all of a sudden they have to opt in to marketing, people don't like to opt in, right? People don't like to have to spend the time to think about whether they should opt in. So the empirical studies show that there's a big difference when you set up an opt-in versus an opt-out regime, and I think that Congress has to be very careful not to set the bar in such a way that they really hurt the services and the products and the good things that consumers get from the use of their data.
Any concluding remarks? With that, I thank everyone for joining us this morning. We are pleased to share with you everything that's going on in Washington. If you have any questions, our contact information, email, and phone is in the material, and would be happy to talk about any follow-up you might want.